Hey guys, Mike with Flight Bridge Ed. I've been an EMS training officer since 2008, and I don't know how many times I've had to deliver the bad news to someone about an expired certification. That means no work. That's where Piace comes in to save the day. Never be caught off guard again with an expired cert. Go to the App Store for your device and search for Piace, P-I-A-C-E-T, the one-stop application to manage and share all of your certifications. You know you don't want to be that guy or gal, and don't rely on your agency to tell you about your certifications. Go to Piace to manage your own certs and have some peace of mind. Download Piace today.
What is a lighthouse? It is a tower with a bright light at the top. Located at an important or dangerous place. The main purpose of a lighthouse is to serve as a navigational aid and to warn of dangerous areas. Welcome to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast. Illuminating the darkness of current EMS clinical practice with the bright light of science. Here are your hosts, Dr. Jeff Jarvis and Mike Verkest.
Howdy, y'all. This is Dr. Jeff Jarvis with another episode of the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast. As a matter of fact, if my calculations are correct, this should be episode 47.
His calculations were, in fact, not correct. My dad is a dork, and this is instead episode 49.
So there I was in the airport. And that's not really true. I was actually at ASEP World Headquarters. We were doing a board review course for the EMS physicians who are getting ready to take their ABIM board. Big course. We had about 40 people there in person. We had another 60 or so there online. As usual, this was a great course. Dr. Mike Levy and Brian Clemency put this thing together with the help of the folks from NAMSP and ASEP. As always, this was a wonderful course. This was the course that I took to get ready for my board exam, and it was a real honor that Mike and Brian invited me to come teach. I got to see my good buddy Ritu Sani there. It was wonderful seeing everybody in person. And there I was sitting there reviewing my slides when I get a text. The text says, "You have got to take a look at this trial." And they sent me to a Twitter link, and the author of this paper, Dr. David Barbic, says, "Hey, my trial is out." And I looked at it, and it was a randomized clinical trial of ketamine versus a combination of Haldol and Versed. And I went, "I have got to get this." So I immediately went, downloaded it, and I read it on the plane coming back from Dallas. This is a really cool paper, and I wanted to share it with you. As you know, it is so timely. Ketamine for agitation is most definitely in the news, particularly for EMS. So I wanted to bring this new science to you. I got so excited. This is all I could think about when I was in the emergency department today. So first, let's get the title of the paper. This is Rapid Agitation Control with Ketamine in the Emergency Department, a Blinded Randomized Control Trial. This is called the RACT trial. And by the way, hats off to the authors, the RACT trial. That's awesome. Great work there. This was published in Annals of Emergency Medicine. I don't know that they have actually assigned it a volume yet. It just came out in what they call their in-press section, which is where you can get it online before it comes out in the paper copy. This was Dr. David Barbic and his colleagues. Great looking paper. Please, it's got some beautiful data visualization that I'm going to put up on the video version of this. Take a look. It's good stuff. All right, so what's the background information we need to know about ketamine? Y'all all know this. Let's go over it really quickly. Ketamine is not a new drug. It has been used for agitation control, for sedation, for analgesia, for procedural sedation in kids, for general anesthesia in other countries. Wonderful drug. It really has been used for years and years and years in pediatric emergency medicine. around the time I was starting as a resident back in 2005, we really started using it in the adult population, primarily for procedural sedation. Then, thanks to some of the great work by Dr. Sergey Motov talking about how to use it for analgesia, we started doing it there in low doses. And we're starting to see some other indications for it also. So it's been around for a long time. It's also been gaining traction in EMS for all of those reasons. But we know there's been some pushback. We just did a study in one of our prior episodes where we looked at how it's been used in EMS, and we had a great interview with Drs. Rimley Crow and Brent Myers where we discussed some of the controversies around it. So that is probably why it was on the top of my head, and I was so excited to get some additional information. So what do we know about ketamine? Well, it is an NMDA receptor antagonist, and it has dose-dependent effects that are also dependent on how rapidly you give it, at least when you're giving it IV. When it comes to dosing, we know that the IM dose is usually around twice the IV dose. Around 0.3 milligrams per kilogram, that's the sub-dissociative or low-dose ketamine dose for analgesia, and then above 1 milligram per kilogram for general anesthesia, typically 1 to 2 is where we're aiming for with our RSI dosing or DSI dosing. And then for agitation, we're typically talking about IM dosing, because if we want to be honest, if we're able to start an IV on them, they're probably not all that violent. So IM dosing for severe agitation, violence, we're looking at either 4 milligrams per kilogram or 5 milligrams per kilogram. So ketamine is generally well tolerated. The thing we like about it, even at the anesthesia doses where they're completely unconscious, the dissociative doses, typically their airway reflexes are maintained. They continue to breathe. That's the reason we like it so much, particularly for intubation. However, no drug is perfect and there are adverse events with it. So if you give the drug too rapidly or if you dose it somewhere in that K-hole range, patients can have some pretty dramatic dysphoria. It makes them very uncomfortable. We don't want that. If you give it too rapidly by IV, you can get laryngospasm. Sometimes you can get respiratory depression or even apnea. Now, generally speaking, the laryngospasm can be broken. It can be broken by pressure on Larson's point right back here behind the angle of the jaw, which also is a nice place for your fingers to go while you're doing a jaw thrust, which might be helpful in laryngospasm. Respiratory depression is typically transient, and you can usually, generally speaking, handle these patients' airways just with airway maneuvers and maybe some oxygen, maybe some ventilation for a short period of time. You can also see hypersalivation. You can see tachycardia and hypertension and measurable increases in intracranial pressure. And when I say measurable, it means if you have a bolt in the brain, you can measure it, but it's really probably not of clinical importance. But you can measure it, so we'll talk about it. The tachycardia and hypertension are typically transient again, don't have a clinical impact. And that hypertension typically comes in patients who are euvolemic or eutensive to begin with. We're starting to see some evidence in patients who are already hypotensive or have a shock index greater than 0.9 that ketamine, particularly given rapidly IV, may get us into problems. Now, the good news is none of these are typically as big of an issue when you give it IM like you would for rapid control of agitation. Now, the one thing that can happen, we frequently don't see this in the field, but we can see it in the emergency department, is this emergence reaction where you put them all the way down with ketamine and then they begin to wake up. And they typically wake up in the same state that they went down in. And most patients that we are sedating for agitation aren't in the best state when they go down. If they have an emergence reaction, typically Versed is a decent dose or a decent drug to use for that. All right, so we mentioned the indication. So intubation is a big one. So agitation control when they're violent is good. Procedural sedation. If we're going to stitch a kid up, we're going to put a shoulder back into place. It's good sedation for that. Now, there are some off-label uses that we're starting to see more often. So there are a couple of patients that neurologists are starting to use this for in my area for migraines when nothing else is working. Dr. Ken Shepke and his colleagues down in Florida have done a nice paper on it for when nothing else is working for status epilepticus. We're even seeing some uses for it for depression. So it really does seem to have a lot of uses. But the one we're particularly talking about here is violent patients, highly agitated and delirious patients. So let's talk about that patient population. So to be clear, what patient population we're seeing here, this is the acute, undifferentiated, highly agitated delirium. So patients are not rational. They're not able to give us a history. They are almost by definition failing all other efforts to control their behavior. So this is a multifactorial state. So maybe they're highly agitated because of some sympathomimetics they've taken. So some cocaine, some ecstasy, maybe a little methamphetamine. Maybe it's just alcohol. Maybe they're just not very nice when they get drunk. All of these things can go into, and maybe it's all of the above, can cause this undifferentiated delirium. But the problem is we don't know what's causing it. That's kind of the issue. We have tried, and this is really important that you document this, not just that you document it, but that you do it and document it, that you have tried multiple de-escalation strategies, you have tried verbal de-escalation, you have tried use of force, none of these things are working, and you have a reason why other medications are not useful, particularly things like benzodiazepines or antipsychotics. And the primary reason, at least historically, that we said those were not useful, they're not good, is because they would take too long to work, and we would need to titrate their dose up. And by the time we get to a dose, particularly of benzos, we get to a dose that's effective. Now we're in the range that they start to have difficulties with their airway. So if all of those are present, we also need to have some objective measure of document assessing and documenting their agitation level. The RAS or the Richmond Agitation Severity Score is perfect for that. That goes all the way up to positive 4, and 3 or above is considered severe agitation. So if all of those things are in place, the patient is an active threat to you, to your staff, to themselves. This is when we need to chemically restrain them. Again, these classic sedation approaches, so benzos, everyone will say, well, just give them some benzos. Well, that's great, and it's the drug of choice if we know it's, say, alcohol withdrawal or if they're agitated because of methamphetamine or other sympathomimetics like cocaine. The problem is you typically have to titrate the dose up. You either go really, really big and run the risk of making them not breathe, or you titrate up, which by definition takes time, time that you don't really have. Another option is the antipsychotics, haloperidol, or my favorite, droperidol. Those are great options here. Olanzapine is another option. But these drugs are great if this is primarily a psychiatric issue that is leading to the agitation. For psychosis is really good for that, but the big downside is how long it takes to have an effect. At least that's what we've always been worried about. So those are the alternatives. Now let's talk about this trial. This is, as I said, the RACT trial, a rapid agitation control with ketamine in the emergency department. A good, again, props to the author's great name. This was a single study, prospective, randomized controlled trial with at least some blinding in it. This was done at a single center, as I mentioned. This was in Vancouver, British Columbia, up in Canada. This was an IRB-approved trial, and I think that is really important to know. Some of the comments I saw on Twitter were, I believe, from some people who were concerned about the social justice issues surrounding ketamine, or at least that ketamine has been pulled into, and they didn't understand this paper and they didn't take the time to read it. This was an IRB-approved study, and it did have waiver of consent. And I think if you understand that the inclusion criteria by definition would preclude people from having decision-making capacity, you can understand that. So let's take a look at the population they recruited. These were adults age 19 to 60 who presented to their large academic medical center. So they see around 90,000 patients. And if you're not familiar with ED volumes, that's a big department. These patients had a documented RAS score of 3 or above. And remember, the score goes to 3 and then 4, 3 and above, severe agitation. As with all studies, they had exclusions, so you could not be enrolled in the trial if you had already been enrolled in the trial, if you were pregnant or breastfeeding, or you were in police custody. And I really, just because of the issues in Colorado, I want to stress that if you were in police custody, you could not be enrolled in this trial. So if you had a documented hypersensitivity to any of the drugs in the trial, you were excluded. And you had to have presented at a time when one of the trained research associates were there to monitor you. And those research associates were there from 8 a.m. until midnight. The patients were selected by the emergency physician. They said, no, you need chemical restraint. And then the research associate would come make sure you're eligible while you're being enrolled. All right, so the methods I mentioned, randomized controlled trial, you were randomized in groups prior to the study, and there were some envelopes that had sequential numbers on them. An emergency department nurse would come, they would get that piece of paper, they would open it up, and it'd have the drug assignment. So this is the only part of this where there was no blinding. The nurse would open it up and say, aha, this is the drug we're going to give. And then they would administer the medication. Nobody else was unblinded, meaning the treating emergency physician, all the other doctors, all the other nurses, and the research associates were all blinded to what the medication was. So that's how this worked. They wanted a sample size of around 180. They wanted 90 people in each arm. All right, so what was the intervention and control? So the intervention arm was ketamine IM in big boy doses. So they went with 5 milligrams per kilogram IM broken up into 2 injections, and they're using the 50 milligrams per milliliter vial sizes, concentration sizes, and they would give a max of 4 milliliters in each one of their injections. So that was the intervention. The control was a combination of 5 milligrams of midazolam or Versed plus 5 milligrams of haloperidol or droperidol. So again, 5 of ketamine versus 5 and 5 Versed haloperidol. Their primary outcome was the time to adequate sedation. And they defined adequate sedation as a RAS score of -1 or below. So time to adequate sedation. And then their secondary outcomes, they wanted to look at the need for rescue medications. They wanted to look at the occurrence of adverse events. And then after, for the next 3 days, they wanted to look for the presence of neuroleptic malignant syndrome. This is something we can see with antipsychotics. So they wanted to look for that. All right. So the results, well, they wanted 92 patients in each arm. They ended up getting 80 patients total. And the reason for that is they timed the study very, very poorly. Unfortunately, they had limited foresight and did not see the coming of a pandemic. So their institution issued a moratorium on all research. That went into effect March 13th of 2020 because COVID. So all trials had to stop. They had already collected data. Again, they had total 80 patients evenly distributed. So they said, let's at least analyze this and see what we got. Most of the patients, not surprisingly, given the fact that this is agitation, most of the patients were men, and most of the patients, almost three quarters, were brought in by EMS. So this is very much an us population. These are the patients we're seeing. Everything else was evenly distributed between the two arms. So the adjusted odds ratio for adequate sedation after adjusting for age, gender, and baseline RAS scores, and we're talking ketamine versus the Haldol Versed, so a higher odds ratio means ketamine works better. The adjusted odds ratio is 2.43. That had a confidence interval of 1.4 to 4.1. 2.43, that means you got better sedation with ketamine than the Haldol and Versed. It happened faster. So average time was 5.8 minutes with ketamine versus 14.7 with the Haldol Versed combination. That's a difference of 8.8 minutes, and that was statistically significant. You had a 95% confidence interval, anywhere from 3 minutes to 14 and a half minutes. So it was statistically significant, and that was the difference. So basically, ketamine worked faster, and it saved about 9 minutes. So I mentioned the groups were pretty evenly matched. Well, let's talk about the exceptions, and you can see this in Table 1. More men got ketamine than got haloperidol Versed, so 85% versus 50%. And the baseline RAS score was higher in the ketamine group than in the Haldol Versed group. It was, you had a RAS of 4 in 64% of the folks who got ketamine versus only 45% who got Haldol Versed. So baseline imbalance, and you would say, well, which group would that tend to benefit? And since the outcome here is time to adequate sedation, you would think that the folks who had lower agitation scores at baseline would do better, would be more rapidly controlled, and that would be the Haldol Versed. But what we found is ketamine worked better. So this trial, this baseline imbalance that just happens at random, was biased against ketamine, and yet we still saw better results with ketamine. Let's talk some data visualization, shall we? Yes, Jeff, I think we shall. There are two graphs that I'm going to put up in the video version, and then we'll attach them in the show notes. The first is a Kaplan-Meier curve, and what this shows is the percent of adequate sedation at different points in time, and they measured this in five-minute increments. The red line that you're seeing is the proportion of patients at each increment who were adequately sedated. The blue line is Haldol Versed, red line is ketamine, and what you can see is a very sharp break point. At all points, ketamine had a higher percentage of patients adequately sedated. The next visualization, I really like this because it's got beautiful colors. This is a sexy plot, and I'm all about sexy plots. Let me kind of describe this to you. There are basically two charts that are put together. The top chart is the patients that got ketamine. The bottom chart is the patients that got midazolam Haldol. Now, the color on this represents the RAS score. So darker red is a higher RAS score. Darker blue is a lower RAS score. So the dark blue means that you are heavily sedated. The dark red means you're heavily pissed off. And what you can see at baseline is that is a red, red line. And then as with time, there's a lot more blue. But if you look at each increment, there are a lot after the baseline, there are fewer patients in red. So in other words, it's working faster. I like it. Beautiful visualization. Let's talk adverse events. So there was no statistical difference in adverse events anywhere. There was, you know, we traditionally say when things are not statistically significant, there was a trend to something. Really, that's kind of statistical fuckery. We shouldn't do that, as Rimley would say. But I will just give you the numbers. 5% of the ketamine folks had apnea versus 2.5% in the Haldol. Said again, not statistically significant. There was more patients, 2.5% versus none, that had dystonias. 2.5% with laryngospasm in the ketamine group versus none in the Haldol Versed group. And again, not statistically significant. And when you look at need for supplemental oxygen or airway intervention, it was exactly the same, 2.5 in both. All right, so let's hit on what the some of the limitations. So first off, inadequate sample size, no fault of their own, thanks COVID. They had to cancel this early, completely understandable, but it's still a limitation of the study. And the reason that's important is there was a big effect size when it comes to time to sedation, but there didn't look to be much difference in side effects, so a smaller difference in side effects. And it's possible that if they had enrolled more people, they would have been able to see a difference in side effects. It's possible. Also, a limitation is that they had that limited enrollment due to availability of research assistants. If that is a big issue, we would have to think that the patients that presented between midnight and 8 a.m. when research associates weren't available was fundamentally different than those presenting between 8 a.m. and midnight. I seriously doubt that, but I'm not an ER or EMS doc in Vancouver. Who knows? Maybe. Doubt it. The other big thing is this blinding issue. The nurse who was giving the drug actually knew what drug she was giving. So it's not a double blind study. The reason they said that she did not or he did not give that information to anybody else, but there may have been, and I'm sure they didn't, at least intentionally, there may have been some subtle clues. Who knows? Probably not, but that's a possibility. So we have to think about that in terms of limitation. So I want to read their conclusion, and then I'll give you my bottom line. So their conclusion is that in emergency department patients with severe agitation, IM ketamine provided significantly shorter time to adequate sedation than a combination of midazolam and haloperidol. This study did not have sufficient power to assess potential differences in safety. All right, so that's their conclusion. First off, what's my conclusion, my bottom line? I think this is a reasonably well-done study. I'm a little bummed that it wasn't double-blinded, and I'm a little bummed that they didn't get the full sample size. Aside from that, I like this study. I think it asks a really important clinical question. It compares ketamine in a big boy dose to real-life adult doses for Versed, Haldol, and they did that combination. So this was not a trial that was set up to show ketamine works. I think that 5 and 5 Versed Haldol, anybody would say that is a good comparator. So I think that is a good thing. I think that it shows us, even with the small sample size, that ketamine is faster for rapid control. I think that, and it turns out that supports my intrinsic bias, having used Haldol Versed and droperidol and comparing it to ketamine. Ketamine just works faster. I think most of us recognize that. I think it is good information that there was no difference in side effects, but that sample size limitation is a real one here. So that is my bottom line. I think this is a great paper. As always, I think you should read it, particularly the discussion. Some of the best parts of a paper, once you finished analyzing the science, happens in the discussion, and that is where the authors try to put it in context of what we already know. So it reviews some of the other literature surrounding this. It's a great read. I highly recommend you get it. And really, I geeked out on the data visualization. I really love that. Beautiful colors, gave the information we want, just like good data viz should. All right, that is what I have for you. I am ketamine, cures what ails you, but it's not without potential adverse events. Always be careful when you're treating any of these patients, regardless of whether you call this excited delirium, agitated delirium, delirium with violence. I don't care what you call it. What I care about is these patients are getting assessed and managed in the most appropriate way. If you have tried verbal de-escalation and that does not work, and you've determined and documented a good objective tool for agitation, then I think rapid sedation is in order. I think ketamine is a good drug for that. Remember, we have got to adequately monitor the patients, whether it was with ketamine or Versed and Haldol. You got to have them on blood pressure. You got to have them on EKG monitoring. You got to have them on pulse oximetry. And for the love of God, put them on continuous waveform capnography. If you do that and you're prepared to deal with any potential adverse events, either from ketamine or the alternatives, I think it's a great drug. The other thing that this provides context to in terms of adverse events, even though limited sample size, I get that, is we frequently think when we're talking about the adverse events of ketamine, we talk about it in isolation, and you can't talk about it in isolation. You, as a treating clinician, you have to make a decision. Am I going to do nothing? Okay, there are bad things that can happen with that. The patient can hurt themselves. The patient can hurt other people. The patient in the process of physical restraint can get hurt. We know that restrictive asphyxia can be a problem, positional asphyxia, all the things, those are bad. Okay, so you can use ketamine. That could have adverse events, but if you don't just leave them alone and use other drugs, those other drugs can also have adverse events. This trial gives us some evidence that they're really pretty even. So I like it. Good read. Check it out. Thanks, Shell. Well, guys, I hope now that you have heard all about the details of this paper that you are just as excited about it as I was when I first read it. I think this paper has some really good information for us, some things that we can take away and add to our knowledge base and add to our clinical practice. I think maybe this gives you an idea of why I'm so excited. Well, I'll tell you what, here is another thing I'm excited about. We got to sit down with Dr. David Barbeck straight from Vancouver to get some behind-the-scenes information about this paper. We got to talk to him about why he thought this was a good and interesting thing, some ideas about how they were using ketamine before this, some good information about how they monitored patients, and what he thought his important takeaways from this paper were. So thank you so much to Dr. Barbeck for sitting down with us. Let's roll that interview, shall we? All right, guys, welcome back. So we are really fortunate that we have the primary investigator of the RACT trial here with us. Dr. Barbeck, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Let's just get you to introduce yourself so everybody has an idea where you're from and kind of what environment you work in so that they might be able to better understand the environment of the trial.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. So my name is Dave Barbeck. I'm an emergency physician and clinician scientist in Vancouver, Canada. I'm a practicing full-time emergency physician at St. Paul's Hospital, which is an inner-city academic center in downtown Vancouver. And we serve a population that encompasses everything from heart and renal transplant patients and complicated medical patients to a high proportion of patients that are highly marginalized, mental health and substance use challenges. And I'm originally from Vancouver and did a lot of my training in sort of central Canada and Ontario and Quebec, and then managed to make my way back out west a few years ago.
By the way, you are in one of my favorite cities in the world. I think it is just absolutely gorgeous. And every time I get up to the Pacific Northwest at all, I come home and I'm like, look, I don't know why I live in Texas. I love Texas, but I'm not sure why I don't live up there. It's absolutely gorgeous.
Well, from what I've seen of Texas, it is beautiful. So I do understand the pull. So
why don't we start off? Can you tell me a little bit about what got you interested in ketamine research?
Yeah, so I think if anything, it was throughout my training and my early part of my staff career, I sort of realized that some of the medications we're using are not ideal in terms of adequacy of sedation, but also rapidity of sedation, getting fast, effective control. And that was part of it, but also the fact that we had a couple of M&M cases that I helped review a few years ago that they were patients that came in initially as mental health or substance, and they received multiple doses of sedation over a 12, 24 hour period. And it kept getting chalked up as, you know, it's mental health drugs, and thorough detailed assessments of these patients' labs were not able to get performed. And as a result, like, one of these patients actually ended up having MRSA bacteremia and ended up getting very, very, very sick. That sort of spurred me on and said, you know, we can probably do better in terms of sedating these patients quickly and effectively so that we can do a thorough exam and get labs and, if necessary, imaging. And I was very fortunate to have some very motivated, very experienced colleagues and collaborators, which were able to push this trial forward.
What's funny, you mentioned that about the patient that you can't adequately assess because they're too agitated. I mean, that's just straight off of our board exams about the, you know, the person who's just drunk and just sleeping it off. And it turns out what they're sleeping off is a subdural or an epidural.
Yeah.
So I think frequently we might hesitate a little bit to sedate patients, and really we're not doing them any good because they really do have a medical emergency that we need to find, but can't because they're too agitated.
I couldn't agree. I was just going to say, some of the internal data that we have, we've looked at about 900 cases of substance psychosis in our department. And of those, about 10 to 15% have some form of occult pathology that warrants either a consult or an admission to, say, our internal medicine service or our ICU. And, you know, that does still mean that 80 to 90% are substance or mental health, but 10 to 15% are, they have a, you know, metabolic, infectious, traumatic emergency that can very easily slip below the radar.
Yeah. You know, we have a fair amount of meth use down here, and a lot of people under the influence of meth aren't the most nice people in the world. So we have this saying that, look, meth may make you a jerk, but it doesn't protect you against other badness. So you got to still look for all the other things. Well, you mentioned that you have, your hospital sees a fair number of agitated patients, and you mentioned the mental health and substance abuse, but can you give me a kind of rundown about what proportions of your highly agitated patients that need sedation? Is this mostly from drugs, from alcohol, from some sort of mental health issue? What's the rough proportions?
Yeah. So of our patients that present with mental health and substance use, probably only about maybe 5-10% of them are agitated to the point of needing intramuscular sedation. But of those, probably about 80 to 90% of them are related to either mental health or substance. And it's probably about a 50-50 split there. I could probably get you the exact numbers, but that's a rough breakdown. We unfortunately do have the scourge of crystal meth here in BC as well. And, the sad reality is that it's very cheap, very easily to access, and as a result, we'll never be lacking for work.
Yeah, well, exactly. It is, at least there's that, you know, job security. I mean, it sucks seeing the impact of folks, but it is nice to have a job. Well, we compare that, and that's roughly similar. I think maybe mine is a little higher from substance abuse, a little less mental health, but still a lot there. And you look at studies you had mentioned, our Australian colleagues, the dorm study is a big one. The Australians seem to like to live up to their reputation, and they have a huge proportion of their agitation that's alcohol. And I think this concept of what is the makeup of your agitation is sort of important, because when you look at the agitation literature outside of the emergency department, most of it is in the psychiatry literature, or it's in the substance abuse literature, and they know what the diagnosis is up front. We don't have that luxury. We're dealing with undifferentiated agitation. So we really have to get them sedated so that we can figure out which bucket to put them in, if you will.
Yeah, very true.
Well, if you don't mind, you obviously you're interested in ketamine, but you had to come up with a comparator for your RCT, and you chose haloperidol and midazolam in what I think are really good doses. I like the 5+5 because a frequent criticism of RCTs, particularly industry supported RCTs, which obviously yours was not, is that they pick a comparator that it's going to be really hard not to win against. And you have a great comparator. 5 and 5, I think, are very realistic medications. What was it that made you select the haloperidol, midazolam, and that combination as opposed to, you know, I don't know, something else, Geodon or, you know, anything else?
Yeah. So I think haloperidol is sort of, up until recently, is sort of probably the gold standard for intramuscular sedation across most of North America and Australia and Europe. And it's what I trained with. It's what a lot of people trained with and were comfortable with. I do appreciate that droperidol is out there. We don't have droperidol in Canada yet, again.
My condolences. May it come to
I've heard nothing but good things. And midazolam is a reasonable starting benzo, rapid acting. And we actually had a bunch of different sedation bundles in terms of whether it was going to be lorazepam, haloperidol, or midazolam, haloperidol in different doses. And we wanted to get a sense of what our regional perspective was. So we surveyed the emergency physicians that we could access in Vancouver and Victoria, which is sort of a smaller sister community just nearby. And we got about 85 responses, and the overwhelming first choice would have been 5 and 5. So that was sort of our go-to, and we felt that it was the most reasonable, most generalizable to the rest of North America.
And I would agree. My experience down here in the South is that that's sort of a go-to, very, very common. So I got a methodology question for you here. When I think I first saw your trial on Twitter, which is one of the few things Twitter is good for, other than as an American, it makes us want to jump off cliffs. But Med Twitter, I think, is one of those points where that's what keeps me engaged with it. I saw your trial, and then I went to PubMed and looked for it, and I saw two hits. You were the lead author on both. The first one was not the trial. It was the description of the trial before you had done it. So would you mind just kind of walking us through what you did leading up to beginning this study and why you felt like you needed to publish that initial study?
For sure. Yeah. So great question. I mean, the actual idea for the trial started probably back in about 2016, maybe early 2017 with some initial meetings and these M&M cases that I talked about. And then over the span of sort of 6 months or so, we started putting the study team together and building the study idea up. And probably similar to the US here in Canada, if you want to run a trial on a medication that is regulated by Health Canada, you have to get Health Canada approval. So part of that was having a very detailed bulletproof protocol for the study in place, which you have to submit to Health Canada and get their approval. And it goes through a bunch of physician peer reviewers at Health Canada. So we had the protocol, and then it was simply a matter of saying, well, one, let's publish this and just sort of declare what we're going to do, because we're going to do it anyways and put it up on clinicaltrials.gov. But also it gives, I think, a valuable benchmark for anyone who's going to look at your trial afterwards and say, well, did you actually say what you're going to do? My background is in epidemiology and ABM. And one of my biggest pet peeves is when you see a trial that has been done and then you look at the protocol and they've moved the goalposts and the endpoints and managed to do some statistical chicanery to get stuff approved. We wanted to be very upfront and honest, especially with the fact that this is going to be used by emergency physicians and EMS clinicians, that, you know, we're not going to pull the wool over your eyes and tell you that we were planning on doing one thing and then do another.
Yep. Well, so that was sort of a trick question because I really wanted to get that concept out there. But you, when you brought up Health Canada, that was really interesting to me. And I'm not sure that that may be different than what we do, or I may just not understand. So we have a, our FDA is who sort of authorizes drugs. We can clearly use it off label, if you will, but our FDA doesn't typically get involved with our, approval of research studies. We have local IRBs, institutional review boards that are governed by, you know, all the same regulations that I'm sure every country's IRBs are. Is Health Canada both a regulatory agency for drug approval and sort of a national IRB?
They don't act in an ARB, IRB fashion, but I think particularly because this was a study using ketamine in an off-label fashion, and ketamine falls as a controlled substance in Canada, similar to an opioid. And then our comparators are also controlled substances in midazolam and haloperidol. They needed to be, we needed to get their approval to be able to even submit to our IRB. So we had to go to, through Health Canada first, get their approval, submit to our local IRB. Then they had to sign off, and we had to send Health Canada relatively regular updates in terms of study monitoring and study completion and all this kind of stuff.
So is Health Canada your provincial health, what we would call an health insurer?
No, they're the equivalent of the FDA.
Okay.
They're a federal body that oversees approval of medications and vaccines and that kind of stuff. So very similar to the FDA.
Okay. Very good. Well, so, and you also mentioned clinicaltrials.gov. Can you describe what that is?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. So clinicaltrials.gov is essentially a registry created by, I think it's the NIH, to allow for prospective registry of clinical trials before they start. And essentially the gold standard now is that you must register a trial if you want to get it published with clinicaltrials.gov or the other, forget what the name of the European alternative is, but there are a few. And so given that you're our best friends and next door neighbors, clinicaltrials.gov made sense.
Yeah. And so I love that concept because I like the way you said statistical chicanery. Being Texans, we're a little more blunt about what we call it. There are some F-bombs involved. But I think particularly when you're looking at trials that where there is a huge financial stake, so industry sponsored studies. And obviously this was not industry sponsored, but you have somebody who really wants to make sure they see one result and they run the trial and they don't get the result they wanted. So suddenly the primary outcome changes. They sort of swap it with a subsequent outcome. Mm-hmm. And you would think publishing on clinicaltrials.gov would stop that. I still think it helps. I'm a huge advocate of it. But I guess when you have huge chutzpah, you just do it anyway and hope nobody notices.
Yeah. Well, and you've got to keep shareholders happy.
Well, I guess so. I'm glad that's not my job.
Yeah, me too.
Well, so from another methodology standpoint, this was not a triple blinded study. The patient was obviously blinded to it. The physician who was ordering it was not blinded to it. But if I read it correctly, the patient and the physician were blinded.
Yep.
But if I read it correctly, the nurse who was giving it was not. Did I get that right?
Yeah, correct. So there was one person in our resuscitation bay trauma room that was unblinded, and it was the nurse that had to essentially pull the randomization envelope out of the box, pull the appropriate medication out of our Omnicell medication storage system, draw it up and administer it. But the treating physician, the patient, the other nurse that was in the room that was doing vital signs and sedation scores and such, and then the research assistant that was measuring other stuff like sedation scores and vital signs and outcomes, they were all blinded. So it was just the one nurse that was giving the medication that was unblinded.
So I think any randomized control trial is a bit of a compromise between if you were just sitting down writing things on paper, what you would like to do if money and resources were not an option, an object, and then what you can actually get done. I'm assuming that you had, you were not able to have a pharmacist blindly. And I don't even know, can you mix? I think you can mix haloperidol and midazolam in the same syringe.
Yeah, you can. We have a, we had, thankfully, a wonderful pharmacy team that helped support us at our institution. And they had, set up bundled medications in a particular drawer of the OmniCell. So the nurses had to sort of choose the name of the study and the name of the patient, and then it would pop open. But they could actually see what the vial was. But we had a very detailed training video for all of our nurses that work that area of our department, and they all sort of went through it and they signed off and they said, "Yeah, I understand. I'm going to try and not tell anyone what's going on. I'm going to try and keep it blinded." There were provisos that if there was deemed to be some kind of critical safety incident, they could disclose to the treating physician. I think that only happened once or twice in the whole trial when the physician said, "I have to know what they got." But the rest of the time, they remained blinded.
So that's sort of an interesting thing. I can think of one situation where I would really want to know, but I'm kind of curious. What do you happen to remember what the circumstances around that were?
Yeah, one was our episode of laryngospasm. We had one patient that experienced laryngospasm twice in the span of 10 minutes. And we had it reviewed by our independent medical monitors, who were also both emergency physicians, but not involved with the trial at all. They were at other locations in the province. And they felt that it was reasonable to deem it as one event. And so the physician found out that they had received ketamine for that one patient. And then the other one, I think, was an episode of dystonia, I believe. I'll have to get back to you on that one.
The dystonia was the circumstance I was thinking about.
Yeah. Yeah.
Makes sense. So I'm assuming then that you don't think the nurse administering the drug influenced the results, at her knowing or him knowing about it. You don't feel like that was influencing the results of the trial?
I don't think so. I hope not. I don't think so. And why I say that as well is that we had developed this training video for our nursing staff with a couple of our experienced nurses, and we just kind of walked them through what we thought was reasonable. And whenever they gave the study medications, they just said, you know, "Study medications given." And that's, we've gone through a bunch of the charts, and that's what it says. The paper nursing documentation from our nurses says, you know, "RAC study medication given." It doesn't actually say, you know, ketamine or midazolam, haloperidol. It just says study med given at time, whatever. So we feel like there was an element to that. And we surveyed our nurses to sort of get a sense of the blinding, and we surveyed our research assistants, and they all remained blinded. The sort of the guess of what you think they got is pretty 50-50 split. So,
yeah, that's sort of interesting. There was a trial kind of to your south about pre-hospital trial looking at amiodarone versus placebo. And one of my colleagues was working as a paramedic up there at the time. Paramedics were crystal clear about what they were giving because the amiodarone fizzed. You know, there was a definite difference. So that's good to know. Well, let's talk outcomes. Your primary outcome was the time to adequate sedation. Mm-hmm. What made you choose that as a continuous variable as opposed to, say, a proportion of patients who were adequately sedated within a certain amount of time?
Yeah, great question. So I think part of that was we felt that time to sedation was the most appropriate outcome because that's what really matters in the emergency department. I know a few people feel that they want to have a one drug that does it all. You sedate them, they go down, and you don't have to give them anything else. And given the nature of our patient population where I work, the dramatic rates of polysubstance use and the speed of metabolism, which patients can sort of just tear through these sedation agents, we didn't feel that was reasonable. So getting initial control so that you can do a thorough assessment and then if necessary, ordering PRN sedation after that seemed like the most reasonable approach. So that's why we chose time to sedation as our initial outcome. And then the reason we chose it to be continuous is that we felt that the granularity of the data would be lost if we chose sort of 2-minute or 5-minute intervals for sedation time points. A few other studies that have looked at either ketamine or other things have looked at that in sort of the 5-minute intervals fashion. I just think something's lost when you arbitrarily chunk it up like that. And we were very fortunate that our biostatisticians that were supporting us felt that they could handle that in their analysis and their modeling. And so that's a big reason why we went with the continuous outcome.
Fair enough. Well, and also the continuous variable, it certainly made for a nicer plot. So you have a nice sort of Kaplan-Meier type plot in there that I think is very revealing. I mean, I think so are you familiar with the cartoon XKCD?
No, sorry.
So it's a cartoon by a science nerd. And he does like nerdy type cartoons. And he had one about the mRNA vaccine trials. And he said, basically, you know, and he showed the plot that, you know, we're all familiar with by now about the efficacy. And he said, your goal in science is to have data so clear that you don't have to do statistics on it. Yeah. And if you look at that, that plot in your paper, it's pretty clear. I mean, I don't really have to do a lot of statistics to see there's a fairly clear difference.
Yeah. We were very fortunate in that worked out that way. I mean, I had a suspicion before we started the trial that it might be like that, but we didn't know. And that's a big reason why we needed to do the study. Mm-hmm. And given all the challenges and the curveball that COVID threw us last March, we're fortunate that we were able to get the number of patients we did get enrolled, but,
So speaking of COVID, so I've had this saying that I had all these great plans going into 2019 and COVID ate every last one of them. It looks like it took a pretty good chunk out of this study too. Can you sort of describe, I mean, I think I talked about it in the original monologue, but what was that like to have spent so much time? I mean, you were at least 4 years worth of work before you started enrolling patients, and then this pandemic hits and you have to stop enrolling. What was that like?
Well, I mean, it was frustrating, but we had to be realistic as well and say that, you know, after a couple months of the pandemic being declared and it became pretty obvious that this was not going to be a quick resolution, we sort of came to the decision with our team that it was time to shut the study down and do what we could with the data that we had. An important caveat as well is that when we were planning this study and designing this study and developing this study back in 2017, 2018, we were seeing an enormous surge in particularly amphetamine stimulant-induced agitation and psychosis in our region. And very similar to other places in North America, we've seen a huge amount of death and devastation due to fentanyl contaminating local drug supply. And it was right around that time, 2017, 2018, that really became an issue locally for us. And so, sadly, we probably had a large number of patients that we had seen previously with agitation or were going to see again with agitation who ended up succumbing to fentanyl and carfentanil overdoses. And our provincial numbers are just staggering. And it certainly hit that hard hit. Hard hit that marginalized population that we serve.
Yeah, and so it's interesting you were saying that a lot of the patients that might have been enrolled in this trial because they were patients before may not have because they died from, you know, their underlying substance abuse disorder.
Yeah.
Knowing how COVID has a tendency to be really preferentially bad in underserved, low resource communities, I would imagine that a lot of those same people were unduly hit by COVID also.
Yeah, you're probably right, unfortunately. Yeah.
So I'm assuming that when you're, and I guess this was province-wide that you just said, that's it, we got to COVID is now an issue. We've passed our threshold. We have to stop all research. Was that the issue?
Yeah, our local IRB basically, I think when this sort of came, when it becomes the snowball effect in sort of early March 2019 for us, they imposed a moratorium on in-person research that lasted, I think, in the neighborhood of almost a year and has been lifted now, but we wouldn't be able to conduct the trial as we had with in-person research assistants and some of the things that we were doing, it just wouldn't be feasible. So,
and that was the
after about 2-3 months, we sort of realized where this was heading, and we decided to, yeah.
Yeah. And that was the main reason, the idea, what COVID had to do with it is unnecessary exposure of your RAs, your research assistants.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit of statistics here. One of the things that you report, in addition to the really easy to understand X number of minutes with ketamine, X number of minutes with Haldol and midazolam, and here's your difference in 95% confidence interval, you also created an adjusted hazards ratio.
Yes.
Can you just walk our folks through what a hazards ratio is?
Yeah. Great question. So I may not be the ultimate defining authority on this, but essentially it's your...
Well, the good news is we don't have a lot of statisticians listening to the pod. We have a lot of clinicians. So I think your explanation is exactly what we're looking for.
It's essentially the odd that you're going to be sedated with ketamine versus the midazolam halidol comparator at a certain time point. So our adjusted hazards ratio is about 2.4. So you're roughly 2 times more likely to be sedated with the ketamine than you are with the midazolam haloperidol group at any given time point.
Very good. So because of COVID, I think that hazards ratio of 2.43, I think is fairly clear. That's not a small difference. I think that's obviously clinically significant. It's obviously statistically significant. I don't think that's small, and which is a fortunate thing from your research because you had to cut it off quickly. I think if you had had even more numbers, honestly, it probably would have been about the same here. The real question, though, is on adverse events. So you didn't see any difference in adverse events. What impact do you think the limited sample size may have had on your ability to detect adverse events?
Great question. So, you know, the majority of the research that's been done on ketamine so far in terms of emergency department-based sedation has shown that there is a risk of apnea and intubation needed for some of the patients receiving ketamine, but also for some of the patients receiving other medications, which I think is an important caveat. And that risk seems to be even higher in the pre-hospital setting due to a bunch of different factors, which, you know, we can all postulate on. Our study was underpowered to be able to comment on the risks of intubation. I fully acknowledge that. But it should also be noted that none of the patients in either of our two study groups needed to be intubated. We had one episode of laryngospasm. We didn't observe any other severe life-threatening complications. We had a few episodes of patients needing supplemental oxygen or to bag valve mass ventilation for a few minutes, which all resolved. And we didn't see any neuroleptic malignant syndrome in the group receiving midazolam, which are all very positive things. But I fully acknowledge that, you know, our study is underpowered from a safety endpoint perspective.
So when you're talking about adverse events, one of the things you mentioned was the need for oxygen therapy, and it didn't seem to differ between groups. One big thing here, because both of these groups have the potential for respiratory depression, that kind of brings to mind appropriate monitoring afterwards. Would you mind talking to us about how you treated these patients in terms of monitoring versus how you might do for procedural sedation for shoulder reduction or abscess IND, something like that?
Absolutely. So we essentially treated this trial as procedural sedation for the Vineland patient so that we could assess them and take care of them. And so they were in a high acuity area with one physician, a couple of nurses, a cardiac respiratory monitor, they had oxygen saturation, they had inline capnography on their nasal prongs, and we were able to monitor them very closely for the initial 30 minutes and sometimes up to an hour, but the initial 30 minutes was the primary concern. And because we figured that was probably the most potentially bad time frame from the time of initial medication administration. And so I think, you know, a key thing for anyone that is looking to maybe implement this at their local emergency department or in the pre-hospital setting is that these patients have to be watched closely and have someone who's ready to intervene if there is something that occurs in terms of airway issues or apnea or laryngospasm. It's not a sort of sedate them, leave them in the corner and walk away and forget about them kind of scenario.
Yeah. I'm so glad you said that. That's a really important point. So in one of our prior episodes where we were interviewing Dr. Brent Myers and Dr. Rimley Crowe about what the national, you know, characteristics of ketamine use are, I want to say we did great. We, meaning EMS, did great from a blood pressure pulse oximetry standpoint. Well above 98% had pulse oximetry, but somewhere around, you know, 2/3-ish had capnography. And maybe some of that was just because it was given in subdissociative doses. But I think the bottom line is that capnography is clearly an earlier indicator of respiratory insufficiency. Yeah. And we can do better. EMS, let's just make sure we got these folks on capnography. Yeah.
And that fits with what we know from the procedural sedation literature and the eMERGE in terms of reducing a shoulder or, yep. or a fractured wrist. The capnography is your friend and it'll help you out.
Rimley there actually had a great analogy. She said, if you're looking for respiratory depression and you're depending on pulse oximetry is in your rearview mirror. You see where you've been. Capnography is through your windshield. And I'm like, Rimley, I love that. I am so stealing that.
Yeah, you're not driving backwards. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, I love it. I love it.
So
I'm going to use that for our, I'm going to use that for our trainees. That's
really absolutely good. Steal it. I think it's great.
Yeah.
You used, if I remember correctly here, you used as an indication for enrollment in the trial, a RAS of 3 or 4. Was that right?
Yeah. Yes. Correct.
Is a RAS score, is that something that you do as just part of a routine practice for sedation? Was that there already, or did you implement it just for the study?
Great question. We, you know, it was kind of a positive spinoff of the study in that our nurses weren't super comfortable with RAS before the study. And then with the training, what we did for about 75% of our nursing group in our department for the study, they became very comfortable with RAS, very comfortable assessing with it. And now we still have RAS cards from the study that live in our trauma room. And when our ICU team comes down and says, okay, well, we can take the patient in an hour and a half and we have a bed, can you keep them at a RAS of -1? Our nurses know exactly what they're talking about. So it's kind of been a knock-on positive effect of the trial in our department.
I have to say, now I'm really, really jealous. So not only are you in Vancouver, which is one of the most beautiful parts of the world that I've seen, you get patients into the unit in an hour and a half. I am so jealous.
Oh, no. That's after they've already been in the department for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours. But once they come and tell us, they can take
I
them.
See. I see. Yeah. That's on a good day with a headwind and lots of free pizza.
Yeah. And the cardiac ORs are not going and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, exactly.
I like it. So you published this in Annals of Emergency Medicine. By the way, congratulations. That is not an easy feat. Annals, for our listeners who may not have tried to get something into Annals, it is a lift. It's hard. They have a methodology editor. They don't just depend on peer reviewers to do the methodology. And they can be real sticklers. So getting it into Annals is quite the accomplishment. So congratulations on that. One feature of an Annals paper is that they have the Annals capsule summary, and a lot of journals do it. The paper I had published, the editor said, well, Jeff, what's your Twitter, you know, what's your tweet? Give me the bottom line on the study. So we talked about what the capsule summary was in the monologue, but why don't you tell me, what was your biggest takeaway from this study?
Yeah. So I think for severely agitated or violent patients, ketamine does provide faster sedation for initial sedation compared to midazolam and haloperidol 5 and 5. I think with the important provisos we talked about earlier, that there need to be people around that are comfortable dealing with any potential adverse events, including airway issues. And these are patients that need to be monitored. They should ideally be on a monitor for 30 to 60 minutes and have close observation.
Perfect. I like it. I think that's a great tweet. I think that's even under 250, 240, whatever, whatever the character.
Something I struggle with. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank God they have that little digit thing that tells you when you're getting close. One last thing I wanted to go back to, and we were talking about adverse events and you had mentioned the laryngospasm. Do you happen to remember how, obviously the patient didn't need intubating, but how did they resolve the laryngospasm? What did they do? Just in case any of our listeners run into this issue.
Yeah. So the first, it was one patient, two episodes of laryngospasm within a 10 minute window. And if I remember correctly, the first episode resolved with jaw thrust, supplemental oxygen and suctioning. And then the second episode was jaw thrust, supplemental oxygen, and about 30 seconds of bag valve mass ventilation. And this helped just the repositioning and the suctioning, I think. And it was probably partially due to the hypersalivation that you sometimes see with ketamine. And that precipitated the laryngospasm. And so thankfully that patient didn't require intubation. None of the patients in either study arm did. But I think early and appropriate intervention for laryngospasm can abort a lot of those.
The amazing power of the jaw thrust.
Yeah.
Wonderful stuff. So your primary outcome was the time to adequate sedation, and you found just under a 9 minute difference with ketamine being faster. That's obviously clinically significant, or I'm sorry, that is obviously statistically significant. Having had, a patient beat me up in the back of an ambulance, I would say that would be clinically significant, but I'd like to get your take on it. Do you think that's a clinically significant result?
I do. I think one of the key things is that not only is it for our safety and our staff safety, whether it's in the pre-hospital or the emergency department setting, but it's also for the patient's safety. And 10 minutes of extra thrashing around and restraints, potentially dislocating joints, other issues associated with that is far from optimal for our patient's safety. And so I think if we can get them settled, get a proper assessment going earlier, just as if it was an unstable trauma patient or an unstable patient with a STEMI, this is very similar. We need to be able to take care of them and assess them in a rapid, effective fashion.
Yep. I agree completely. This is great. I really, really appreciate you taking the time to have a conversation with us. And again, congratulations on a wonderful trial. I think this is really, really impactful. I give a lecture on the top 10 papers of whatever year it is, and your paper is definitely in there. I have a funny feeling. Do y'all do LLSA articles for your board cert in Canada? LLSA is lifetime learning self-assessment. We're assigned.
Like the sort of continuing. We do, but we our sort of ongoing certification is a bit different than the ABEM process. So, it's not sort of pre-specified what you have to read.
But, I see.
Yeah.
Well, we have that process for emergency medicine, but we also have it for EMS. And I'm submitting this RAC trial as a suggestion for the next EMS board. I think I'm biased. I'm doing it for EMS, but I think it would be a good fit for EM too. So, congratulations, man. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you so much for having me, Jeff. It's been a real pleasure.
You have a great day.
Yeah, you too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Cheers.
You've been listening to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast, a proud member of the FlightBridge Ed podcast family and a Fire Dog production. Visit FlightBridgeEd.com for more information.